Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you've been to Atlanta, to Charleston, to Raleigh or Mobile, you've seen the South. But to truly experience the Deep South, to even begin to understand its social structure and its economic condition, and to see how the past informs the present, you need to go beyond the big cities. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Paul Theroux has been to the far ends of the earth, traveling on foot, by rail, in kayaks, and on camels. And then, in his fifth decade as a travel writer, he made the radical decision to hop in his own car and travel more than 4,000 miles of southern highways and country roads, seeking to understand the people who make their lives there, how they relate to one another, and to the fascinating but troubled history of the places they live. Paul Theroux's earlier books include The Great Railway Bazaar, Riding the Iron Rooster, and the novel The Mosquito Coast. His newest travel memoir is called Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
How do you define the Deep South?
I'd say the Deep South is a region that starts, for me, it starts in South Carolina, goes to Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas. It's a fairly coherent geographical place, but as you said in your introduction, it exists mainly in its back roads and small towns.
What makes the back roads and small towns so different from the cities? Are the cities more sort of generic to the extent that they have, you know, the same strip malls and sort of cultural objects that you'd find anywhere in the United States?
No, I don't think that. I think you find strip malls everywhere. You even find some little tiny strip malls in small towns. I'd say it's the population, the roots. The roots in the country areas go very, very deep, you know, hundreds of years in many cases. And the memory of the past is very, very strong. The cities, Atlanta, for example, Montgomery, Little Rock, you find immigrant populations. You find, you know, Syrians, Indians, Pakistanis, you know, people who never heard of the Civil War, people who can't name the president. There's lots of that. In the back roads, there's a strong memory of the civil rights movement, of people who participated in it. There's a memory of the plantation. There's a memory in some cases of slavery, of people who can recall stories passed down. So I'd say it's the continuance, it's the sense of time, the persistence of memory, and that for a writer is a really valuable thing, because when you the whole point of writing about, you know, travel is people's stories. It's not sightseeing. It's listening to what people have to say, the things that they've seen, the things that they've heard, and writing that down. But this book is not about me. It's about other people, the people that I met, and not people in the city.
When you go into a small town where people are likely to notice a stranger with Massachusetts tags on his car, how do you carry yourself as you're going around to get a feel for the place? And, you know, how do you sort of wait or proceed with the questions that occur to you?
I think the Massachusetts place don't matter, but I think that you, in all travel, you know, Flaubert once said, travel reminds us of how small we are in the world. We're just very tiny people. We don't matter. You go, and you have to have a sense of humility, a sense that other people are the story. And I think before anyone's going to tell you their story or trust you, you have to make a friend of them. You have to reassure them. You have to, you know, you don't stick a tape recorder in their face and say, tell me a couple of things about, you know, what do you got to say? I found it the oblique approach the best one. I went to church services. I went to gun shows. I went to football games. I went to concerts. I went to events, you know, where I would meet people who talked, people who I could develop a relationship with. And I found, you know, that you mentioned also in your introduction that I went 4,000 miles. I actually went more like 25,000 miles because I took a number of trips. I would go 4,000 miles in one, say, one little season. But the plates of the car don't matter. A woman told me in Alabama, I said, I'm a stranger here. She said, there ain't no strangers here. And that's a Southern attitude. You're not a stranger. You're welcome. But people aren't necessarily going to tell you how much they earn, how many children they have, or where they work until you or bare their souls if they're not a friend.
Was there a point the first time that you went down for purposes of this project, right, that you thought, okay, I've arrived in the South? Was there like a first destination that felt different from the places you had been before?
Oh, yes. Yes, in a major way. I drove down, so I drove down from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. It was the fall of 2012, before the presidential election. And it's roughly 550 miles to Fredericksburg, Virginia, and then another 500-something to Allendale, South Carolina. When I got to Allendale, I thought, I am in a different world. It's the low country of South Carolina, the poorest part of the United States I'd ever seen in my life. As poor as anything I've seen elsewhere in the world, almost. It was a Route 301. You can find it on a map. Excuse me. And when I saw that, I thought, this is something that I've never seen, something I want to know more of. So Allendale was a town that had been on the main north-south route to Florida. It then Route 95 took over, and the town died. But not only that town, but every town along Route 301 died. So it looked like some dystopian, terrible doomsday fantasy. But people were struggling. I mean, so there were a lot of motels. They're all closed. A lot of convenience stores closed. Gas stations all closed. It looked like, you know, a plague had hit the place. And I thought, here's something to write about. This is the beginning of the story. I've never seen this before.
Why do people stay in a town that has died?
They can't leave. They have no means to leave. They have, excuse me. I have no, they have no relatives outside the South. Many do leave, of course, but there are people who cannot. The people that I met there were so far below the poverty line that they couldn't, you know, they didn't have bus fare to Charleston. So they're stuck. And my book is not about just sad, poor people. It's also about people who are trying to change things. So there's a man, he's called Wilbur Cave. He is a founder and activator of an organization called Allendale County Alive. He's had, on a very small budget, he's helping people fix up their houses. He helps arrange for people to get loans, employment, health care. It's just this, you know, basically a one-man organization who's trying to improve things. He gets no help from Bill Gates or Bill Clinton or Mark Zuckerberg or anything like that. He just has very, very small grants, but he's doing something. So I was interested in the interplay between people who, you know, the submerged 20%, way below the poverty line. In some cases, it's 40%, and the people who are trying to change it, based really on the book that inspired me, which is Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by James Agee and pictures by Walker Evans. In the 1930s, he went to Greensboro, Alabama. So he was writing about sharecroppers, tenant farmers. And we have an analogous underclass in the States, which exists now, and they're as poor as they've ever been.
The advantage that someone like Wilbur Cave has in, you know, not getting a lot of outside help, working with this very small budget, is that he's not being told by someone else what his community needs.
No, that's very true. That's a very accurate assessment because he was born there, went to school there. His mother was a teacher there in Allendale, and he's committed there. He's part of the community. It's very, very important. You know, when a do-gooder, a philanthropist, goes to Africa, meets the president and says, I'm going to fix your problems, he has a dinner, people dance for him, and he goes home. He doesn't speak the language. Clinton does not speak Swahili. Chelsea Clinton just makes visits. Bono, Gay, whatever, they visit. It would be very important if people like that actually lived in the place that they're trying to help. I joined the Peace Corps in 1963. And for the next 6 years, I lived in Africa, Central and East Africa. And whenever people came and tried to help, they usually had a very, very mistaken idea of what our problems were. I was first in Malawi and then in Uganda. And I think the same is true in the South. You need to actually talk to people on the ground, not to the governor, not to the legislators, but to people in the small town and say, how can we help? What most of them need is a job. They need work. And the work has been outsourced, taken away from them. It's in Mexico. It's in China. It's, you know, elsewhere. So the outsourcing has seriously impacted the economy. It would help. Instead of giving people money, it would be much better to start a factory or put them to work. Then you don't need Habitat for Humanity. They can get a mortgage and build their own house.
What happens to the identity of a factory town when the factory closes its doors? Are people able to make sense of what remains?
No, they don't know what hit them, because for generations, people worked in a factory. The children usually were apprenticed, and they work in the factory, say, making Schwinn bikes in Greenville, North Carolina, or furniture in parts of Arkansas, and, you know, other industries. There's plenty of them. And what you say, what happens to their identity? They identify. It becomes, the company town loses its identity. It's people who used to work for the factory. An example might be, Monroeville, Alabama. Monroeville, which is the setting for To Kill a Mockingbird. That town wasn't identified with To Kill a Mockingbird. That was Vanity Fair Textiles. Vanity Fair employed 2,500 people until just a few years ago. So it wasn't Harper Lee. It was Vanity Fair. And the company went elsewhere, India, Mexico, God knows where. And 2,500 people, many of them women, lost their jobs. So it's a small town, Monroeville. Harper Lee still lives there. And there is very high unemployment, and there's no industry to speak of. Same is true, Forest City, Arkansas, Clinton's home state. They made television sets in Forest City. They made very high-quality ones. They now make them in Mexico. So, you know, we have a serious problem in the states. And these are small towns. Monroeville's tiny. Forest City's small. And they lose their industry, and they lose their identity. And they lose their the cash flow. So suddenly people think, where do we go? Go to a city, find a job there? Go to Mexico and work in the same factory? It's a very, very serious problem. And throwing money at people, you know, building houses for them, doesn't work. What works is the self-esteem and the cash flow that people get from having a job.
One thing that is strange is that no matter where you went, no matter how poor it was, the roads were pretty decent compared to a lot of other places that you've been in the world.
Yes, that's true. And that's why the greatest experience you can have in the United States, in the world, I think, the greatest one in the world, is an American road trip. You can get in a car anywhere in the States and drive, you just keep driving and driving. The sense of freedom is enormous. Even the only really bad roads that I saw were in the Ozarks. In Arkansas, you find dirt roads. I mean, they're fairly well maintained, but they are dirt roads. And there's some, here and there in the South. But in general, we have the best roads in the world, the best cars in the world. And so this sense of freedom, which I've never experienced in traveling, I mean, I've traveled in India, in China, I took trains everywhere. I've taken my kayak, as you pointed out, and boats and whatever. I've never had the sense of getting in the car and just going and listen to the radio and just flying through the landscape.
My guest is author Paul Theroux. His latest book is called Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Remember, you can vote for your favorite Think programs this year at kera.org/think. We will play a week of the best, the week of December 28th. We'll come back to our conversation with Paul Theroux in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Georgia. Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
That, of course, was Ray Charles singing Georgia on My Mind. We're speaking this hour with author Paul Theroux, whose latest book is called Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Paul, readers will associate you with travel all over the world, not in the United States. Why did you decide to do a book on a domestic trip now, and why did you choose the South?
I think because the last trip that I took was in Africa. I had gone from Cairo to Cape Town in a book called Dark Star Safari, and continued Cape Town up to toward the Congo through Angola. That book is called Last Train to Zona Verde. And when I was in Angola, I kept seeing the, I guess, the influence, cultural influence of the U.S. You see it in Africa a lot. You see it all over the world, hip-hop, rap, kids with baseball hats and T-shirts, you know, skateboards, and even in graffiti, all the rest of it, all these manifestations of urban American culture you find there. And I was thinking, you know, it's very interesting. I'm seeing people who are deeply influenced by the States to the point where, you know, go to any classroom in Africa or maybe in India or China too, and say, where would you like to go? Where do you want to spend the rest of your life? They'll say the United States. I want to leave my country. And I thought the sense of being in America is so strong in the places that I've been, and so different from what the way it was in the 60s. In the 60s, people wanted to stay home. Now, people want to go to the States. I was thinking, this is an aspect of my traveling life that I've neglected. Also, it's very important to know your own country, to know your history, to know the events. And I thought, you know, I come from the coastal northeast, Boston, Massachusetts, and I thought, you know, I really should do that. When I was very, very small, I went with my uncle to Fort Lee, Virginia. I was about 9, 10 years old, and it left a deep impression. I thought, I want to go back to that place, Fort Lee, Hopewell, Virginia, and I want to continue. And the idea that Southern literature is so strong in American literature, I mean, I'm a reader, that I wanted to see the landscapes of Southern fiction. I wanted to see what the country looked like on the eve of the 2012 election. And then I wanted to keep traveling in four seasons. And the more I traveled in the South, the more I was convinced that this is, in a sense, the ultimate travel book, traveling in your own country, in your own language, in your own car, and stopping with all the time in the world. I mean, I'm an unemployed writer, so I got all the time in the world to do this. And to me, it was a very, very liberating and enlightening experience. I give the impression, maybe I'm just talking about poor people, but I talk to people who are very joyous, very hopeful, very optimistic, and people with deep roots and the persistence of memory with a sense of history, which is so important in our country and in any country. So there's lots to write about. And the more I traveled, the more I was convinced that I was on to the right thing, that this is what I was, you know, destined to do. A book not about me, but about other people, not about the difficulty of the trip or anything like that, but about the way we live now. And so that's what it was. Deep South suggested that all to me.
What is the process by which you, on the one hand, hold on to the way that your ideas about the South have been informed by, you know, reading the literature of the South and seeing movies, but you also need to go in, I would imagine, without, you know, being too hung up on any preconceived notions. So what do you do with the things that you think you know about a place you haven't been before?
Oh, that's a great question, because literature can inform you, but it can also mislead you. When I lived in England for a while, and people used to come to England and think, I'm going to take tea. I'm going to go to Wimbledon. I read Charles Dickens, Henry James. I'm all, you know,
I got this, right?
All geared up for that. And then they meet, you know, soccer hooligans. They get insulted by English people. There's no tea available, and it's more like Clockwork Orange than you know, Henry James. It's so The same is true of the South. I mean, people read Faulkner and they think they know the South, or they read Flannery O'Connor and they think they know the South. Well, they don't. They don't. A lot of Southern literature is rooted in the deep past or is stereotypical. So you get the freak show of the South. I mean, a lot of it is just grotesques, the fantastications, you know, the crazy old neighbor, the lynching, whatever it is, the Faulknerian people. Faulkner's fiction stopped in 1940. Right? His Delta Autumn, which is the story that is most recent in time, is 1940. Although Faulkner was living in Oxford, Mississippi, when they were having serious problems. They were trying to integrate the Ole Miss, and he was sitting there, didn't write about it. So I reached the conclusion that Southern fiction can be deeply misleading, and that the best way to know about the South is, definitely read something, but get in your car and go there, and you'll find a different place. You'll find a different slice of America, and you'll find people who are, underwater in economically, and they're not the stereotypes of Southern fiction, but they're individuals who I found became very fast friends. And this sense that literature hallows a place is very important, because when people read about the place, they associate it. It's why people go to Monroeville, Alabama, and they think they're going to find To Kill a Mockingbird territory, and what they find are unemployed people in a rather a decaying Southern town. And it's not the Boo Radley, To Kill a Mockingbird place. It's a different place, but you've got to kind of get the book out of your mind in order to see what sort of a place it is. And the same is true of Greensboro. I mean, Greensboro was written about by James Agee, but James Agee did not write about African Americans. He wrote about white sharecroppers. So if you read that book, you think you're going to meet, hard-up sharecroppers. You don't. I mean, the civil rights movement occurred after Agee was there. So Let Us Now Praise Famous Men is a very misleading book about Greensboro. I mean, great things are happening in Greensboro, and also some people are still, behind the eight ball there. So worth visiting and worth writing about, and the literature doesn't help.
The kinds of details that you notice in your experiences and that you choose to describe for us are very interesting to me. I've been thinking a lot about a small thing that you noticed, which was that there were some African-American people that you met in your travels, and we should say that you're a white man. When you invited them to call you Paul, your first name, they would almost reflexively call you Mr. Paul.
Yes, it's a mark of respect, but I asked that. It was always Mr. Paul. This is a convention in the South that I found, Mr. Paul, rather than my last name. We have a difficult last name, Theroux. It's a French name. But they said it's a habit from slavery. And that's something that that I found. The habit of the plantation still exists in some people's minds, both black people that I met and the white people that I met, because the plantation passed away, relatively recently, and the people who worked on the plantation picking cotton still live there. Virtually every older person, African American person that I met, had a memory of picking cotton. And of how much they could pick in a day, how many pounds, how many bags. And, there are people who, in many cases younger than me, a person in their 50s or 60s would say, after school we used to pick cotton. And any plantation or any sort of agricultural endeavor is very slow to change. And so the habits die hard, the habits of the class, who's carrying the water, where you can eat, where you can, sit under a tree. All the conventions of agriculture are pretty fixed. So these cultural things are amazing to record, amazing to witness, and they become the very stuff of the narrative, too.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Donna on the line in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Chris. I'm really enjoying this fascinating conversation, and I wanted to make one quick point. In the South, I'm originally from Texas, lived in New York City 20 years, and also in Europe. Anyway, It's calling people, for example, Miss Donna is true among white Southerners as well. I have many white friends who call me Miss Donna. I was a ballet teacher. All my students' parents used to call me Miss Donna. So it's not only a black to white thing. But anyway, a friend of mine went to Oxford, Mississippi with her husband and found, unlike you, Mr. Theroux, she did not find it welcoming. She found a great deal of anti-Yankee bigotry, anti-Yankee sentiment, and real resentment. And she had a really hard time for a long time transitioning. She's from Larchmont, New York, lived in Europe, lived in New York City. And now she's doing much better. They bought a home. They have land. But it was a hard transition for her. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, thanks, Donna. That's, and it's also what Donna says is true, that white to white, people say Mr. Paul, Miss Donna. That's true too. Anti-Yankee sentiment is strong among whites. I found in the South. I was in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and I was at a restaurant at a round table where a stranger could sit. I sat with a group of about eight people, and as soon as I sat down, the woman said, "Where are you from?" And I told her. And she said, "Do you know what you did to us?"
Wow.
And I said, "No." She said, "You made us eat rats." She's referring to the siege of Vicksburg, 1862, the siege went on for months and months, and they did indeed have to eat rats. And I pointed out to her that I personally had not done that to her, nor that was some ancestor and so forth. And then we had a conversation about the Civil War. I mean, I'm very interested. I'm not offended by it. It makes a great moment. Do you know what you did to us? So you, meaning Yankees, yeah, this anti-Yankee sentiment all over. And the welcome, a lot of the welcome that a traveler gets is, hello, stop by, I'll tell you my story, let's be friends, and then you move on. I don't know what it would be like for a Yankee to live in the South, but I suppose it might be difficult because of the stereotype. And they think you come from the North. An outsider is often seen as an agitator. And traditionally, outsiders have been agitators in the South, changing things. Oxford, Mississippi, which Donna mentioned, when Faulkner said, we'll integrate in our own time. We don't need the federal government to come down here and tell us what to do. That's William Faulkner, Nobel Prize winner, you know, sage of the South, wise man. He's saying, don't mess with us. So, you know, even the wisest man, he was there at a time when they were trying to integrate it. And as I said, he didn't help. So, yes, anti-Yankee sentiment. It's not so much even anti-Yankee. It's sort of the anti-outsider. But you're dealing with communities that are coherent, that have been there for a long time, and they outsiders have tried to change things. So it's quite understandable why a Southerner would be suspicious of an outsider. What is an outsider going to bring something great to the place? Probably not. He's going to bring his own attitudes and so forth. But the Civil War is a theme that runs through the South, and it's one that interested me greatly. The idea that people were still aggrieved and felt defeated by it. They felt defeated. Whites feel defeated by the Civil War. They feel defeated by the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement was a war. They feel defeated by that. And what was that all about? That was about local people being angry and other people, the federal government and civil rights workers coming in and agitating, you know, for good, but still outside meddlers. So, you know, it's all in a good cause, but you can understand why people say things like that.
You went to a number of gun shows on your travels, and they happen in states outside the Deep South. Is there something about them that is uniquely Southern somehow?
No, I don't think so. I think that the gun shows are a feature. You have them in Texas, I'm sure, all the time.
Absolutely.
Probably every weekend. Every weekend you got one. We have them in Massachusetts. They tend to occur a lot. The key thing to understand about a gun show is that it's not only about guns. It's really about like-minded people. It's people who feel that they have to band together to protect their rights. Gun rights is the stated theme, but it's not about guns. It's about, again, it's about meddling, the federal government telling you what to do. A gun show is a group of like-minded people. They're all interested in the same thing. They're interested in the Civil War. They're interested in history. They're interested in antiques. It's not just about buying an AK-47. There are people who sell knives in gun shows. They sell, you know, a handmade thing, moccasins and so forth. So when you go there, it's like going to a Masonic lodge where people, basically are on the same theme, and it's guns, theoretically. But also they're in agreement politically, you know, in terms of, I suppose, religion and their view of the world. And they're willing to talk. If you go there, you know, if you're a writer, you want to talk to people and hear their stories. So the conversations that I heard at gun shows were about, and they're country people too. So they were about, you know, their lives, their work, and their fears for themselves and their families. So, you know, it's not gun nuts at a gun show. It's people who have a view of the Constitution, and you know, some of them are trying to pick up guns. Business is usually very bad at a gun show, but it's more like a club. Generally, they're white people, white men, who feel the sense of defeat and the last symbol of something that they don't want taken away from them is their gun. And I found that interesting and worth writing about.
We're speaking this hour with author Paul Theroux about his latest travel memoir. This one is called Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Remember, we're asking Think listeners to help us choose the best shows of 2015 to replay the week of December 28th when I'm on vacation. You can vote for your favorites at kera.org/think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
That was the band singing The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. We're speaking this hour with author Paul Theroux about his new book, Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. Join us at 800-933-5372. Paul, you write that you winced every time you heard it, but in fact you heard the N-word used in multiple contexts in your travels through the South. Tell us about that.
Oh, listen, you know, I've talked to a lot of people about my book, Deep South. There's a chapter about the N-word, and you're the first person who has actually brought this subject up. So thanks, Chris. This is a word which is in American life, American history, and American music. It's in rap music constantly. So kids hear it all the time. I think of the expression, the N-word, is like baby talk. Don't say the N-word. To me, it's a taboo word. It's a word which some people can use and others cannot use. Whites can't use it. Blacks can use it. And the idea that a group of people can use a word forbidden to other people makes it a taboo. For a writer who uses words all the time, the idea that a word is so powerful that you'll lose your job if you say it, you'll be mocked, you'll be demonized if you say it, as happened in numerous cases, is truly interesting to me. So I have a chapter about the word, where it's used, how it's used, when it's used, who can use it, who can't use it, who's it forbidden to. And, you know, it's like in Tonga, in Japan, in lots of other countries, there are two languages. There's the royal language, and then there's the language of other people. So there's words that a commoner cannot use. A taboo, I'm in Hawaii. I'm speaking to you from Hawaii. The word taboo is, they say kapu here, but a kapu is very strong. A commoner walking in the shadow of a noble was killed because the shadow of a noble was a taboo. It was sacred, and so it's a taboo. You are violating a taboo if you walk in the shadow of a nobleman, not just a king, but a noble person, a person higher than you. So this taboo word, which is, you know, used by, say, someone like Sean Carter, who calls himself Jay-Z. He's gone to two inaugurations. He's a friend and benefactor of President Obama. He uses the word all the time. The word's in his music. Every time I see Jay-Z with the president, or, you know, I think here's a man who made a whole fortune and a career using that word, a word that I can't use. So this is a feature of, you know, life in America. It's a contradiction. And in the South, where it is spoken, the North, it was considered very vulgar. A person using the word was ignorant. In the South, not so much. And I sometimes pointed out, people would use the word, and I say, you know, where I come from, people don't use that word. And they say, well, they sure do here, you know, that sort of thing. So thanks for bringing it up, because no one else has brought it up. It's a very, very delicate subject. And I tried to explain how it was used with me and the history of it and how it's used in books and so forth. And that's, you know, my book, Deep South, is about the culture, the literature, and the texture of the South. And that word is part of the texture of the South.
Did you find, if you were exclusively in white company as a relative newcomer, even if you'd introduced yourself to people, was there any effort before that word was used in conversation to determine how you might respond to hearing it?
No, I found that people would use, they'd either use it casually as though they, you know, it was just part of the vocabulary, or they would bounce it off me to see, you know, like throwing a spitball at me to see, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to object? Am I going to? And I never corrected anyone. I might say, you know, where I come from, people don't say that. But, you know, my job isn't to tell people how to live. It's to record what they say and what they do. That's what a writer does. You need, as a writer, to see things as they are. Not to, you don't go and lecture people. You write about the world as it is, and people as they sound. So it was used in a lot of different contexts, and in the way that it is in the States. Some people testing me, a white might test me. A black person might use it. I found that a very poor black person sometimes might use it, uneducated person, just use it to mean man, or to use it mean to mean person. That blank over there, you know, or a blank can't get an even break, whatever it is. I find it's used. It has multiple meanings, multiple uses, and that's possibly the most interesting thing about it. But I suppose equally interesting is the fact that it is one of the commonest words in the lyrics of rap music. And rappers are not insignificant people. They are multimillionaires, in some cases, billionaire. Dr. Dre, Andre Young, is a billionaire. And his fortune has come from his music. Well, and I suppose selling headphones and things like that. But, you know, it's amazing how you see these people in public life. And I think to myself, when I see them with a politician, because, you know, they give money and so forth, and I see them on television and so forth, Snoop Dogg and Nicki Minaj and Beyonce and all, and Jay-Z, and I think there's a person whose language is different from mine. He's allowed to use words that I can't use. There's a person, you know, it's like being in some weird country where there's an elite who can use words that you can't use. And it's a taboo against me. And I'm a writer. Why can't I use this word, I think? So I don't want to use it. I mean, it's not really in my vocabulary. But I think in that chapter, it's used a lot. And some people were shocked by it. But as I say, Chris, you brought it up. It's a great topic. It's a great topic because it's a forbidden thing. And not forbidden to everybody. It's allowed to some people.
Well, it's interesting that you say it's like, you know, certain cultures where there's an elite and they're allowed to speak a certain language. Because in this country, the forbidden words are only allowed by the people who have been marginalized by those words in the past.
Yes, but that's the point.
Yeah.
The point is that if you have no power, if you are very poor, if you are neglected, if you are marginalized, to use your word, what have you got? All you have is the power to forbid someone to use that word. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So a person has nothing. And so they create a taboo. They create an empowerment and say, by the way, I haven't got anything. You know, my house leaks. I don't have a job. I'm marginalized. I'm despised. And Black Lives Matter. And you don't agree with it. But you cannot use that word. Use that word, and I will punish you. So it becomes a lexical item, a word which empowers people. Ain't that interesting? I mean, that's really, really interesting to me. Because if you got nothing, you can control what people say. And another word, lately people have said thug. The word thug is like a synonym for the taboo word or the N word, you might say. And so you can't use the word thug because that's what thug means. But anyway, it's true. It's the expression of it. It's an underclass. That's it. It's not an elite, but it's a special group, and it's a group that's forbidding you to use the word. So that's, to me, that is fascinating.
When people in these small southern towns had an opportunity to ask you questions, one of the first ones was always about, as is said in the South, your church home, like what your particular denomination of Christianity was the assumption.
Yes, that's true, because you're defined by your church. The churches are not integrated in the same way that schools have traditionally been. You tend to go to the church that you were raised in. So that even in towns that are, you know, where race relations are pretty good, and I would say, you know, most of the towns, race relations were okay, still there are black churches, there are white churches, and you don't find a black face in a white church. And by the way, the other non-integrated institution is the funeral parlor. Mm. You won't find, you know, there are black funeral parlors and white funeral parlors, and you tend not to find a white corpse in a coffin in a black funeral parlor. But so there's that. Barbershops, too. So barbershops, churches, funeral parlors, they tend to be they're the last bastions of segregation. But I found that going to churches, I went to churches all the time because, like gun shows, people are talkative. And I should say also at gun show, people are very polite. You know, when there's a lot of armed men around, they say, yes, sir, no, sir, you scoot on by. No, sir, I'm glad to help, all that. I mean, they're really great. The politeness at churches is similar, I mean, in the interest in the outsider, too. So I found a lot of people that if I went to a church, I was, you know, it's a profession of faith, and people are like-minded. I was often the only white face at a black church, but I was welcomed, and any white person would be welcomed at a black church. And I think probably the same is true in a lot of white churches, but just people don't go. But I got a lot of goodwill, a lot of what they call fellowship at churches. And the church is the beating heart of a southern community for, you know, welfare, snacks, goodwill, advice. Just you go to church and you have people who will help you. And that's why churches were bombed in the South and burned. And if you burn a church, you are attempting to tear the heart out of a community. People in the North would wonder why they bombing churches. Traveling the South, I realized how the importance of a church. Politicians don't care much about people in the South. They defund education. But the churches create education and help people.
But it seems like, you know, contrary to the intentions of people who try to destroy churches, an attack on a particular church almost inevitably makes it stronger.
That's definitely true. And it always backfires because it galvanizes a community into building the church, building a bigger one, a better one, and it's saying they're trying to destroy us. It's this, you know, it's a test of faith. And when people's faith is tested, they come out stronger. No one is saying, oh, they bombed our church, we'll have to, we'll all become atheists, so we'll all, you know, go down the road or move. They always say, no, we're going to build another church. It's, in every case that I can think of, a church bombing has created a stronger community and a better church.
I've always wanted to ask you about this. As someone who has done so much traveling throughout his adult life, what is your relationship to home?
I love home. I'm a homesick traveler. I live, I'm speaking to you from Hawaii. I have a home here. I love being home. I love my own bed. I love my wife. I like home life. I suppose I have a typical bourgeois outlook. So a person with a very strong sense of home is a good traveler, I think, because you set off from home to see a place, not with an intention of moving to a place, but you go with a strong a sense of confidence that you come from, a good home that you love, and it makes it creates a great optimism. Also, I think of a trip. What is a trip anyway? What's the destination of a trip? You set off from a trip from Texas to see the world. What is your destination? Your destination is to get back to Texas. That's your destination, not to go to Rome. You want to go to Rome, then you want to come, then you want to come home. So I think of a very, very strong sense of home and belonging. And I go away. A trip can last 3 or 4 months or 6 months. I went to China for a year. I was in Africa for almost a year. I lived in Africa for 6 years originally, but always with a sense of, I'm going to go back. I'm not going to settle down and stay here. I lived in Britain for 17 years, and I always felt like an alien. I always say, I don't belong. I want to go home. And in the summer, I live, in where I grew up, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and where I love it. And if I came from Texas, Lubbock, Texas, Amarillo, I would want to go back to Amarillo. And that's the way things are. I really have no desire to expatriate myself. So, as I say, the great traveler is someone who is at times homesick. It's not someone who's just going to immerse himself in a culture and say, oh, I think I'm going to become, a Papuan New Guinea, a Tongan, a Nigerian or something like that. You have this sense that you're in a different place. And because it's different, you see it as it is, and you're able to describe it. You don't become absorbed and immersed in the culture. You're always outside it, and you see yourself as an outsider. And that's how I am, a homesick outsider.
The new book by author Paul Theroux is called Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. Paul, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.